are dealing with alien life forms.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you find in Mars?
Subsurface life that has sat and evolved without the competition from the surface that our subsurface life has for billions of years. So it has evolved into a different, strange kind of sentience, and therefore can sense changes around it, but it's not an individual species in the way that we divide up evolution. And so the familiar Darwinian views of natural selection don't quite operate in the same way. There is selection for parts of it, but by definition, the thing has moved all the way around the planet. It's inhabited the subterranean, well, wrong word, really, Mars. I'll think of it in a minute. Ares. Sub-Ares. Not a good word.
Well, the Tarkovsky film, Solaris, or the book, his film came to mind, A Sentient Planet.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, his was an ocean. This is a subsurface life form. The salient thing is that it came from the surface long, long ago, still has a connection to the surface. It's fed by hotter fluids from below, which we know are on Mars, particularly sulfur dioxide. And methane is a waste product for life like this, as it is for our subsurface life, running off internal heat and chemicals. So what does it look like, and can you actually get it to recognize you or to understand that here's another thing from the surface, and what does it think about the surface, and so forth? So I got involved with that, and I still find it intriguing because I think there's a very good chance there is subsurface life on Mars. But I served on a committee at NASA in the mid-90s to look into exploration subsurface on Mars, and we decided that it would cost over $1 billion to do one drilling on the surface of Mars. You got to pick your spot, and you get one drill, and that's it. So we then, this is under Bruce
that's
Murray.
That's a dowsing rod, I guess.
No. Well, you can have a dowsing rod, but somebody's got to hold it. So Bruce Murray was in charge of this, and we started a subgroup to explore robotics and decided that the best way to look for subsurface life was to run a Caterpillar-type robot with a power feed into one of the many caves we know and have seen from orbit on Mars. There are over 100 known caves on Mars, some of them very large, most of them lava tubes from the old volcano Olympus Mons and other areas around Gusev Crater, too.
Could you spell the name of the crater?
Gusev, G-U-S-E-V. It's the name of a Russian astronomer of the 19th century who's spotted it reasonably well. So the robot runs in, and you get subsurface for free because you're in a cave, and you just go as far back in the cave as you can and see if you can find life forms or do a drill in the wall of the cave. This is based on work done by Penelope Boston, who is an old friend and has done a lot of cave exploration for anaerobic, that is non-oxygen breathing, life in places like Mexico. There are deep caves that are totally functioning without oxygen in various parts of the world. Mexico just seems to be the closest one that we can readily get to.
Has there been data gathered since your book that in any way confutes or affirms what you were thinking about?
Well, the number one datum from Mars is the repeating bursts of methane, which we can't explain by any geological mechanism. And it is very odd. And there was a lot of hostility to this view, a lot of skepticism. Chris McKay, an old friend at NASA Ames, said to me about 6 years ago that he was dead certain that these measurements would be proved wrong. Well, he was proved wrong. They're definitely there. We got them from the latest rover. And we're waiting to see if we see more, too. They're local and sporadic, which suggests something. That is that occasionally there are ventings from a biosphere below. We're not talking about a great deal of methane, but there's not a great deal of anything on Mars. The atmospheric pressure is 1/100th of what it is right here. That is one of the problems with The Martian, the movie and the book, that in the first chapter, there's a big windstorm, but we already know that the pressures from that windstorm are not enough to blow over a landing craft, particularly one that was carrying humans. It doesn't make any sense. So that's kind of a false note. The other one is that there's no assigned purpose for that manned expedition at all.
I kept waiting what the agenda was.
The author, a well-meaning sort, really great on details, doesn't seem to notice that the manned expedition doesn't have anything to do. The only measurement he's carrying out throughout the whole novel is to measure the pH, that is the acidity, of the soil. But we measured that in 1977, and we've read it. We measured it repeatedly since. We know what it is. It's somewhat acidic, about pH of 5 or so, 5.5.
I wondered about the landing tilting over, because wouldn't somebody have figured that that was a possibility if those kinds of winds were possible?
Well, look at it this way. The power of the wind is proportional to the density of the air and the temperature gradient that drives the pressure, right? Well, temperature gradients are about the same, actually a bit more than they are on Earth. But the atmosphere is 100 times less dense. There's no storm that can blow over a landing craft. This doesn't make any sense. If there were enough atmosphere to do that job, it would be much easier to land there.
To me, there's a great irony about this book and film, because here we are growing up yearning to go to Mars. John Carter yearns to go to Mars. And in this movie, they're yearning to come back to Earth.
Right.
The trajectory has reversed under our watch.
Well, remember the great exploratory tale, which inspired, by the way, apparently, both The Tempest and Robinson Crusoe, was the story of shipwrecked mariners who tried to get back to England at all costs, instead of saying, hey, we're in Tahiti. We don't want to go back to England. You ever think about that? Why are they desperate to get back to England? Well, it can't be the play's the thing. That doesn't make any sense. But even at the time of Shakespeare, which was a really long time ago, folks, the tales of returning mariners were spellbinding to the English, because, you see, the sailing ship was their rocket.
Well, I wonder if there's something going on in our culture, though, that's fastening on upon a story of coming back rather than going there.
Well, sure.
The movie opens with them there already.
Well, right, because unlike John Carter, we can't plausibly make up anybody to fight on Mars. So what you've got to fight is Mars itself to survive.
Well, that was Stan's biggest chance.
Exactly. Why don't you turn it off? I want to get some coffee.
Yeah.
You know, I've had our little kerfuffle over his latest novel, but that was that's another issue. That's Starships.
Okay. I forget where we were exactly. Well, the idea of the whole
The Tempest.
To come back rather than go there.
Right.
I mean, does that represent a shift in our global consciousness of Mars at all?
It's an important one, in that if you look at the earlier Martian, say, movies, at least, he was either elegiac, Bradbury, Illustrated Man sort of thing, or it was Rocket Ship XM, where you go there and you find out that they had a nuclear war and they've descended to savagery and they don't like us. I was very pleased with it.
They burn up in the atmosphere.
I love that, too.
Anyway.
Yeah, it's cruel. Did you know that they actually threw that movie together and shot it in a matter of just a few weeks on a low budget in order to try to scoop Destination Moon?
And it's much better than Destination
and
Moon.
And it
as
is.
Far as I'm concerned. And did you know that Dalton Trumbo wrote that script?
I didn't know Dalton Trumbo wrote the script.
Of course.
Huh, yeah.
I've got some documentation. A friend of mine owns the rights to that film.
Really? It makes complete sense that it was. I remember liking it.
It's amazing that a film made on a $180 is really much better than a film that went for special effects and cost umpteen million dollars, etc.
Well, that's right.
What
well,
does that tell us?
Well, the wooden hand of Hollywood can do anything with money except typically improve the quality of the script. See, the script's already written, and if you go with a bad script, you're going to get inevitably a dull movie. And unfortunately, Heinlein said to me he too thought it was a bit dull, but he didn't have sufficient hand in the script, and he didn't like the introduction of the Bronx character and so forth for local color and all that, he said he would have made up some more interesting problems for them to solve.
And it also doesn't have the actress Ozzie Mason.
Yes, that's true.
The heartthrob of all of our early science fiction.
Yes, she was our Ursa Major in a way. So I like that film. I really should see it again. It was oblique photography, and as I recall, they shot it somewhere out in the Mojave Desert.
And I know a guy that who owns the rights, they went back and shot some new scenes, because in the original print, the rocket that takes off from Mars is in, what do they call it, the Redstone or something.
Redstone.
With a gantry and everything.
Really? And a gantry set up on Mars? That is a horrible movie.
No, he reshot with a special effects rocket going back.
Oh.
A lot of people hate him for this, but he couldn't stand the idea of the middle of the film having a gaff like that.
Exactly. No, I can understand that.
So we seem to be preoccupied with coming back rather than going. I'm fussing on that.
Well, here, let me give you the deep reason. Ever think about the Odyssey? It is about going out, finding the strange, and coming back.
Yeah.
Odysseus, again and again, goes to a strange place, encounters something, usually a peril, you know, the Cyclops or the Cherberus and Cerberus, and then comes back to a resting place, a city-state. And then goes out again. And it's this oscillation between the frontier and the reassurance of civilization that is, I think, the founding myth of Western civilization.
But then Tennyson takes him back out again.
Yes, yes. Well, you always want to sail back, don't you? Well, that's the point. Because, you see, if you stop trying, you go to hell. Faust.
Okay. Music is everywhere in your stories. This book was my introduction to your short stories, I have to tell you, as opposed to the novels. Yeah, the best of, which is our nominal topic here, I guess. And I'd like to ask you about that. Music and the arts, language, music. It's in the story, The Sigma.
The Sigma Structure Symphony.
Wow, this has got to be some kind of a capstone story for you, and is it going to be a novel? And
yes, David Hartwell commissioned a story based on a painting, and which has now been published in a book of five stories, I think it is, all of which depict this painting as a scene of some kind in some story. There, Gene Wolfe and a bunch of other guys are in it too. So I put it into a novel I'm actually working on very slowly, about a librarian at the SETI Library about 2.5 centuries from now. And I've simply looked at things that could happen to the SETI librarian, and each one I've written as a short story, and this is the latest of those. My next major project, perhaps for 2016, is to shape all of those into a novel.
Because this is the only one of that series I've read.
Yeah. The Sigma Structure Symphony is the most sophisticated story I've written in that series, and the longest. Because I have always been interested in the problem of, it's fine if you have all these SETI messages, but how the hell do you read them? What is your Rosetta Stone to read these essentially ancient texts, because they were broadcast in some cases very, very long ago, or written long ago and repeatedly rebroadcast by what I call funeral pyre beacons in the galaxy, which a couple of papers in Astrobiology, the journal, my brother and my nephew and I presented a series of calculations showing them the most likely kind of beacon to hail people across great spans of the galaxy is a light, almost lighthouse-like effect, in which you send fairly short bursts to attract attention and embed a message that tells you where to look for a rather longer transmission at lower powers. So once you've got them caught their attention with a spotlight, so to speak, you then convey most of the message in something that costs you less money to build. It was an economic view of SETI.
And your character, Ruth, seems to be uniquely equipped to interpret, understand, encode all this.
The character, Ruth, who is the lead character of the novel eventually, has a whole lot of skills that we don't have typically now, and in essentially looking for structure inside mathematical messages, mm-hmm. which if you don't have a Rosetta Stone, is almost the only way you can unwrap a SETI message, because it's got to have lots of clues in the structure of how you read it. The classic example, evolved by Frank Drake and Carl Sagan, was you send them a transmission that is X number of zeros and ones, basically, long, a digital transmission. But that X number actually divides into two primes. That is to say, there are two prime numbers multiplied together will give you X. And then when you plot the zeros and the X's on, say, the width is one of the primes and the length is the other, then you get a picture.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. That method they worked out in the late 60s, I think, and it's still a plausible one. But there are other ways of embedding a clue in a message, and Ruth's story, in part, is about trying to find out these things.
Really, don't we go back to Poe solving the code and the gold bug?
Yes, I mean, right. It's like the gold bug.
Process. Now, Bach and the sigma math hit on the same complex notes. To them, it was a theorem, and to us, it is music.
Right, yes.
Wow, that hit me over the head.
Yeah, I suddenly occurred to me, you know, that we know that in the human cerebral cortex, musical and mathematical information is stored very similarly, and they come from same parts of the brain. And it explains why there's a high correlation among particularly theoretical physicists and mathematicians for music. I don't know if you realize that, but there have been studies done. It's not an accident that Einstein was a fairly lousy violinist, but he was a violinist. And
like
almost every mathematical physicist I know, including me, has played an instrument sometime or another or is a big music fan. I'm particularly a Baroque kind of guy and classical, but I still think it's obvious that J.S. Bach was the greatest musician of all time, and he has no rivals, and which is interesting and mysterious, because this guy died before the American Revolution and we haven't had anyone of that quality since.
Well, there has been work on mathematical structures seemingly embedded in the music, have there not?
Oh yes, there's been lots of work studying Bach's methods, how do you build all these fugues so intricately, things like that. They're as interesting and as intricate as, say, the Chartres Cathedral, if you've ever seen it. When you stand there and look at the majesty of all these soaring columns and these domes, the strut work, and realize that they built it this beautifully, but it's also extremely strong. That this is going to be here for centuries, has been here for centuries, and the necessity made you fulfill the obligation of form follows function. And that's true in music, too, that the form, it follows the function in Bach of constructing intricate mathematical sequences.
And at no time are you saying that there's a risk of rendering the music sterile by dissecting it mathematically. You never imply that. It's not going to happen in your world.
Well, it doesn't happen in the real world because no one would argue that, say, the Mona Lisa is devalued by doing a spectral analysis of its colors. you can understand a thing at a different level by looking at how did he get this color and this strange tint and so forth. And you look at the spectra and you find out that certain bands have been suppressed or enhanced. That's technique. It's like saying, how did they build this Chartres Cathedral anyway? Oh, that's right. That's a hyperbolic art. There's a reason these things work well. I mean, just like the golden ratio, which describes the Parthenon, which is is that there are principles in architecture that emerge from two sources. There's the human aesthetic. Does this look beautiful? And also, is this statically stable? And the Parthenon is actually remarkably stable. After all, it's been here over 2,000 years.
Before we go, can I ask you to read a paragraph of your prose here from Sigma Structure? It's where she sat.
She trolled? Is that the beginning?
Yeah. Could you just read that? I'd love to hear it out.
She trolled the background database and found human work on musical applications of set theory, abstract algebra, and number analysis. That made sense. Without the boundaries of rhythmic structure, a clean fundamental, equal and regular arrangement of pulse repetition, accents, phrase, and duration, music would be impossible. Earth languages reflected that. In Old English, the word rhyme derived from rhythm and became associated and confused with rim, an ancient word meaning number.
Linguistics, music, math, holy mackerel. Thank you for this. Now, I'm going to pair that with the great Galileo quote that you use. And I'm going to ask you where that came from.
You know, it occurred to me, you know, in that thing about rim, I should have mentioned we also get the Arabic word algorithm.
Yeah.
An Arabic word.
Something about reading something out loud triggers.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's one of the things I love most about teaching. Mm. Once you open your mouth and start talking, other things unexpected begin happening.
Well, but it's the origin of the Freudian slip, also the Freudian schlep.